Well, good morning, everybody. It's kind of a special time of year. It's getting cold, snowing. We're approaching the solstice. And tonight, we begin here at the Zen Center a seven-day sesshin, seven-day retreat. And it is to mark the, celebrate the Buddha's enlightenment. Oftentimes during the sesshin, the Rohatsu sesshin, Lake Calhoun freezes. I would say more often than not during that sesshin, the lake freezes. I have my doubts this year because it's been a little bit of a warm year, but we'll see. I have been reading, because of the time of year, a book entitled Winter World, The Ingenuity of Animal Survival. It's by a naturalist by the name of Bernd Heinrich. And in each chapter, he looks at the survival mechanisms that various animals have adapted or developed or invented to live in this climate. When you think about a chickadee, you know, a bird who's probably smaller than my thumb, if you take away the feathers, how it survives through a night that's 20 degrees below zero. It's had to do some pretty amazing things in order to do that. So he looks at a number of these adaptations that animals have developed. And one I want to share with you and it's the adaptation that the wood frog has developed. How many of you know the wood frog, the common wood frog? Not very many, but a few of you. All right. It is it's native to Minnesota. And it, along with three other of its relative frogs, and I won't name them, but they've all developed this one adaptation to cold weather. Some frogs and toads will dive or burrow. Toads burrow, and they stay below the frost line. That's how they adapt to the winter. But these frogs have done something unique as a group. They winter under the leaf litter, so just under a few layers of leaves. They just kind of snuggle in under the leaf litter. Although some of them, actually, we don't know where they all overwinter. The wood frogs tend to winter under this leaf litter. Tree frogs, another one of these species that does this. It's not quite clear where they overwinter. One person found one simply kind of under the loose bark of a tree, just hanging out there. They're pretty exposed, and they've developed this fascinating ability to kind of like instant freeze, deep freeze. But of course, if you're a living being and you deep freeze, instant freeze, you die. I mean, we're mostly, frogs and us are mostly water. And if that water freezes, cells burst, organelles get shattered, it doesn't work. If you and I were to just instant freeze, like step into a freezer, wouldn't work. We'd die immediately. Or as long as it took us to freeze. What these frogs do is, as soon as an ice crystal forms on their skin, it sends through the receptors sends a message to their central nervous system to their pancreas, and it's kind of like our adrenaline, you know, the fight or flight mechanism, where if as human beings and I think all vertebrates actually, if we get the right signal, all of a sudden our body keys in, adrenaline flows, heartbeat increases, glucose moves to the muscles, and we're ready to either fight or flight. So that's a mechanism we have. Frogs have a similar mechanism when an ice crystal forms on their skin. As soon as that happens, they go into kind of super adrenaline mode, and they produce a lot of glucose, a glucose that would put any of us into coma 40 times over. They produce it, and a few other things, and what happens is the glucose moves into the cells and serves as antifreeze. And because of the osmotic pressures, water moves out of the cells. Now, not entirely, but moves away from the cells. What happens in these frogs is their cells basically don't freeze. Their cells have antifreeze in them. All of the water, all of the other water in their body freezes solid. So in their cavities, everywhere else, except for inside the cells, they're frozen solid. So if you were to pick up the leaf litter and find a wood frog, it would be, for all intents and purposes, look dead. It would be frozen, absolutely solid. And yet, come spring, the whole process reverses, and they come out of this, the glucose, they begin to thaw, the osmotic pressures change, glucose moves back, comes down slowly, and they're ready to reproduce, which is what, or sing. And so they're one of the earliest. When you go out in the springtime, when you go out into the woods, you'll hear spring peepers. That's one of the species that kind of does this instant freeze. Wood frogs. Wood frogs kind of sound like, so you all know what spring peepers sound like. They're peep, 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 peep. And wood frogs, which sound like, kind of sound like ducks in the distance. But they all, those are all early breeders. They're the first frogs you hear in the spring, because they do this instant kind of like bang, bang. They don't have to like climb out of ponds, and they don't have to dig themselves out of tunnels. They just unfreeze. So why did I tell that story? It's because I'm fascinated by it. That's why I tell it. That's a great book. You ought to read it. I'll tell you one other short story about the snapping turtles tend to go into small ponds and just go into the muck. And like for six, I mean these are animals that have to breathe. They don't freeze. They stay above freezing temperature, but for 6 months they don't breathe. These are breathing animals, and I won't get into that story. But for the longest time, up until fairly recent history, it was believed that birds did this. Just think about it. All of a sudden, birds are gone. In the fall time, where do they go? Well, for the longest time, it was believed, because people knew things like turtles went into the muck at the bottom of the rivers. For the longest time, people believed that in the winter time, that's where birds went. They didn't go to, they didn't migrate. I mean, the concept of migrating, it wasn't there. So for the longest time, the belief was that birds also just hibernated here in the muck, underwater. Heinrich, in this book, in the introduction, quotes Sigurd Olsen, who's a naturalist from Minnesota. And this is going to be the takeoff for my talk. Sigurd Olsen wrote, "If I knew all there is to know about a golden Arctic poppy growing on a rocky ledge in the far north, I would know the whole story of evolution and creation. If I knew all there is to know about a golden Arctic poppy growing on a rocky ledge in the far north, I would know all, the whole story of evolution and creation. So I'm going to use that quote to springboard into the topic of this talk, which is Jijuyuzanmai. How many of you have heard the term Jijuyuzanmai? About as many of you who have know what a wood frog is, but it's not the same people generally. Jijuyuzanmai is, I'll describe the parts of it. Ji means self. Ju, J-U, means accept. Yu means use or function. And zanmai is the same word as samadhi, which is a Sanskrit. It's Japanese for samadhi, and it means concentration, oneness, or one-pointed meditation. So Jijuyuzanmai means the samadhi, or one-pointed meditation, or concentration, of self-fulfilling activity. The samadhi of self-fulfilling activity, Jijuyuzanmai. It's translated different ways, but that's the one I'm using. And I will maintain that it's just like the wood frog and just like the golden Arctic poppy. Jijuyuzanmai. Ehei Dogen, who's the founder of the Soto School of Zen, considered Jijuyuzanmai as the essence or the right transmission of mind to mind. So when we talk about the unfolding of Buddhism and the transmission of outside of the scriptures, a transmission from teacher to student, in Dogen's mind, what was being transmitted was Jijuyuzanmai, the samadhi of self-fulfilling activity. So it's kind of a pivotal element or concept. So I'll read a short passage from Dogen. This is from Bendoa. Now all ancestors and all Buddhas who unfold Buddha Dharma have made it the true path of enlightenment to sit upright, practicing in the midst of self-fulfilling samadhi. Those who attained enlightenment in India and China followed this way. It was done so because teachers and disciples personally transmitted this excellent method as the essence of the teaching. So he's equating here Jijuyuzanmai, the samadhi of self-fulfilling activity, with upright sitting or zazen, and it is what's passed on from generation to generation. In the authentic tradition of our teaching, it is said that this directly transmitted, straightforward Buddha Dharma is the unsurpassable of the unsurpassable. From the first time you meet a master, without engaging in incense offering, bowing, chanting Buddha's name, repentance, or reading scriptures, you should just wholeheartedly sit and thus drop away body and mind. So again, he's equating, Zazen is the practice, but he's equating Zazen with Jijuyuzanmai, or the samadhi of self-fulfilling activity. And so Jijuyuzanmai, just sitting, which is the practice we do here at this center, Shikantaza, silent illumination are all synonymous. And Uchiyama Roshi, who is a Roshi of the 20th century, equated those all with the Buddha. Zazen, Jijuyuzanmai, silent illumination, Buddha. So what is this? What is this Jijuyuzanmai? maintain it is you and me just fulfilling the moment. We don't have, there's nothing to do, nowhere to go. If you simply bring awareness to what you're unfolding in this present moment, that is Jiju Sanmai. And just as that frog, that wood frog, is an incredibly miraculous, inconceivable, beautiful, sublime happening. We can't conceive of how that frog got to that litter and how it's inconceivable. And just as that frog is inconceivable, glorious, sublime, and beautiful, you, me, sitting on our cushion, doing nothing but being human beings, are beautiful, sublime, inconceivable, mysterious. And simply bringing that existence into awareness is Jiju Sanmai. Katagiri would say, simply just being present is enlightenment. And just being present to our own self-fulfilling activity is Jiju Sanmai. Stated more eloquently by Mitsu Suzuki, a little haiku, while ink dries, early winter shower, mountain hut. While ink dries, early winter shower, mountain hut. Simply the unfolding of the moment and awareness of it. Or as Soen Nagagawa, another 20th century Soto teacher said, wrote, inside the Zendo, also dancing, evening maple leaves. Inside the Zendo, also dancing, evening maple leaves. As we sit, the universe unfolds. We are no different than the universe. Just like that golden Arctic poppy, and just like the wood frog, and just like the snapping turtle, we are unfolding the universe, and bringing our attention to it is Jiju Sanmai, or the samadhi of self-fulfilling activity. But what about all those incessant delusional thoughts? So we sit here and we're a miraculous, inconceivable, and beautiful being unfolding the universe in the moment. And these thoughts, just these constant thoughts come running through, you know. I was sitting here, some of you know I had my hip replaced a while ago. And it's only recently that I've begun sitting, at least even in this position. I can't sit cross-legged at this point. I may never sit cross-legged again. But I got this pain in my hip as I was sitting during meditation. And all of a sudden, it was like, oh my God, this could be popping out. We might have to call 911. Isn't that going to be embarrassing? The teacher's there, laying on the floor, screaming. Luckily, it didn't happen. So what about all those thoughts? So we're sitting here, a great manifest. We are the universe. And yet, it's really sometimes hard to be aware of that and let it just be there. But we are human beings. And just as that frog has an amazing capacity to, you know, in 15 hours to turn itself into totally antifreeze, frozen being that can live through the winter that way. Our thoughts are just like that. Our thoughts are as miraculous as what happens in that frog. Our thoughts are what make us human beings. You should delight in your delusional thoughts. Uchiyama Roshi, again another 20th century. A lot of these guys I'm talking about, Uchiyama, I'll talk about Yokoyama in a minute, and talk about our Soto school teachers who taught either here or in Japan. But Uchiyama described, and I've said this before, thoughts as secretions of the brain. It's what that organ does. Just like the pancreas secretes insulin, just like the thyroid secretes iodine, and those organs secrete a whole bunch more. Again, we're talking miraculous and inconceivable. Just like those organs, the brain secretes thoughts. And that's a glorious, glorious thing. But if you can kind of come at your, as you're sitting, come at your thoughts as simply that, secretions of the brain, the organ doing its work, all of a sudden, they lose a little bit of their intensity. They lose a little bit of their hold. You're able to create a little bit of a space between that thought and who you think you are. And that works on the cushion as well as in the office or on the highway. If you can approach your thoughts or come at them with that perspective, they can become less intense, less burdensome. You can get a little bit of distance from them, and they lose some of their power. Because they really are just illusions. They shouldn't be all that powerful. It's when they are powerful, it's when we run into problems, actually. But so Yokoyama, who was a Dharma brother of Uchiyama, has a great quote. "I am an eternally deluded person. No one is as deluded as I am. I am deluded with gold trimmings. How clear this is to me when I do zazen. According to this teaching, simply the awareness that you are deluded, which comes from zazen, makes you in reality a Buddha. It's zazen that teaches us that we, too, are deluded, and hence delivers us from this very delusion. When we actually practice zazen and look carefully at all the deluded ideas that keep popping up, we realize how ordinary we are, how little we have to be proud of or to brag about ourselves. Nothing to do other than quietly hide away. This is, after all, who we truly are. Satori is being enlightened to the fact that we are deluded." You know, sometimes if you're sitting zazen, if you're sitting for particularly 7 days, you can begin to think that, man, you can get into this, you might call it a struggle, a great effort to, you know, free yourself of your thoughts, let go of your, I mean, you can kind of be intense. And what Yokoyama is saying is, you're just an ordinary Joe or Sally. I mean, this is what it is to be human. And zazen just kind of like shines a little light on it. Just shines a little light on the fact that we are deluded beings. And we are enlightened beings. All at the same time. We are enlightened through our delusion and we are deluded through our enlightenment. So again, and for those of you who are sitting, I'm not sitting all 7 days, but for those of you who are, delight in your delusion. Enjoy it. Have fun with it. Let your thoughts run rampant for 7 days. Katagiri, as I said before, said that enlightenment, and Katagiri Roshi is the founder of this temple, said that enlightenment simply means to be present. To be present to everything that's coming up. And I that means we can be aware, but I don't believe we can actually be aware of everything. I mean, we are so inconceivable. We can't be aware. I mean, there's so much going on in every person sitting here right now that is inconceivable, beautiful, and sublime. And you'll never know it. I mean, you can't. Your mind can't get itself around it. The category said that enlightenment means simply to be present. And this is a quote from him. Jichuyu Zamadhi means you receive your life and simultaneously the whole universe. That is why samadhi is translated into Japanese as right acceptance. Right acceptance is to receive yourself and simultaneously the whole universe. We have to receive the whole universe and use it. You are you, but you are not you. You are the whole universe. That is why we are beautiful. Back to Olson's quote at the beginning about if he could only know everything there is to know about that golden Arctic poppy, he would know all there is to know about evolution and creation. And in some ways, that's what we do as we sit zazen. We attempt to get to know ourselves, which is all we really can know, wholly and fully. And by doing that, get to know the entire universe. Because we really are nothing other than the entire universe. Just as much as a mote of dust is the entire universe. So don't get yourself all fucked up. So, my intention in this... are you listening, Guy? My intention in this...
I close my eyes, I can hear you. I can crawl too.
My intention in this talk is simply to encourage all of you and myself to sit zazen. That's my intention. And to be present to the self-fulfilling activity that is you. Be present to the self-fulfilling activity that is you. In all its glorious delusion and all its glorious enlightenment. To simply be present. And to recognize that it's nothing special. It's just the universe unfolding. It's very ordinary. Very ordinary like that frog is ordinary. Like a turtle is ordinary. Like a poppy is ordinary. And I don't know why, as winter slowly descends, and the lake does its thing, and we do Rohatsu Sesshin again here, that it seems like a perfect time of year to me things are settling in, the winter is going, maybe sit for the entire winter like that frog. Or like that turtle. Just sit in silence as much as we can throughout the winter. That's it, I think, for the talk. I will open it to questions or comments.
that self-fulfilling samadhi is the samadhi that's fulfilling itself, right? Would you say that's the self that's being defined in that phrase?
Samadhi is the awareness, is simply the awareness. There's no way to get around the self-fulfilling activity. It's happening, whether we bring our attention to it or not. That make sense?
Sounds good.
That's it.
Well, let me ask another one. What's the role of reality in this? Or are you just present with your your thoughts and your feelings, and that's it?
Self-fulfilling activity, I think, is reality. That's how I would think of it. Questions or comments?
Well, let me ask another one. Many of the Japanese Zen masters you mentioned were actually pretty avid warmongers in Japan during the Second World War. And as we well know, and some of the greatest of the Zen masters. And so how does that figure in? Did you sit with your delusion? And what happens if it means that okay to invade Korea, enslave people?
I'm not aware of the specifics of any of those, but it's clear that a lot of Japanese folks and Zen teachers got caught up in the war effort and nationalism.
I don't mean it as a criticism. It's just you sit there, and this comes up, and you're with it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if it's really injurious to other people?
Mm-hmm. Dogen often talked about, discriminative thinking has oftentimes has a negative valence. And the discriminative thinking is dividing the world up, and it's not a good thing. However, Dogen did not lambaste discriminative thinking. Discriminative thinking was held actually quite highly by him. I think there's... So sitting zazen and becoming aware of the present moment unfolding and letting go of thoughts which is very ordinary and beautiful thing to do, doesn't mean you don't step outside the doorway and have to think and have to make decisions and make judgments. And from our vantage point, we would say that a lot of those Zen teachers didn't think well. They didn't bring their they didn't use their discriminative thinking particularly well. It's hard to judge from a different time and different culture. I mean, what would we do? There's politics. There's the politics involved in the Soto Church or the Buddhist Church in Japan and all that stuff going on. But I don't think for a moment that sitting zazen relieves anybody from responsibility to behave ethically in the larger community, or behave ethically in the Sangha. And those are different spheres. But
of course, Zen teachers in Japan thought they were behaving
properly. Mm-hmm. Right. Yep.
Yeah.
Hi, Lee.
Hi. So, as I sit and I watch thoughts arise and then feelings and impulses, there's a part of me that goes, oh, you know what that person said in my letter. And I kind of put it out, it's not a good thing to do. And I feel compassion and I have a thing to do. Why is that part of me that's making that decision?
Well, I'd step back one step. And as compassion arises, it is a secretion of the thought. It is a thought. It's kind of interesting. You know, I was just recently thinking about, well, how do I think? I realized I think a lot in pictures as opposed to words or linguistically. But I, at least the way I think of it, those sentiments or emotions, and in Zen, let's use the word emotions. Sentiments, like compassion or emotion, are the same as, they're secretions of the brain. They are, and they are simply secretions of the brain. And so, that's how I would think.
It does.
I worry when somebody ask a question out of looking at their notes. That scares me. I didn't say that.
It says here, delight in your delusional thoughts. I'm wondering, where does effort fit in when we're delighting in our delusional thoughts?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. And maybe I should not have said that. I think what I wanted to get across. So effort. Let's start with that piece. Effort starts with being serious about practice, and sitting your butt on the cushion, and taking Zazen practice seriously. That's where effort comes in. Once your butt is on the cushion. The reason I say maybe I shouldn't have said that is that delight is in itself a secretion. And I guess what I was trying to say is we tend to think, oh, bad thought, or oh, thought. We tend to get caught in to thinking that those thoughts are not enlightenment itself. We tend to want to push them away to gain enlightenment. But actually, that's the wrong effort, to push them away to gain enlightenment. So I said, I think I used the term delight simply as a valence to thinking that our deluded thoughts are anything but enlightenment. So, but I would caution against delighting in delusional thoughts. Thank you for asking that question. Mm-hmm. God, you thought it was going to be fun this session, huh?
Did you say
Dogen
said that, or did that mistake that?
No, I quoted Yokoyama, and who was kind of what was that? I mean, I think that was around the quote of Yokoyama. I'm an eternally deluded person. No one is as deluded as I am. I am deluded with gold trimmings. How clear this is to me when I do Zazen. And then he goes into this riff about how delusions are what make us Buddhas and what make us ordinary at the same time. So no, Dogen didn't say that. It was Lee Lewis that said that.
What does the middle path have to do with all of this?
What does the middle path have to do? Good question. When I think about sitting zazen, and the samadhi of self-fulfilling activity, and being present to what's unfolding in this moment, your experience of what's unfolding is different than mine. With the middle path, and there's probably a bunch of different ways to think about the middle path in that, but here's one way, is that being present with that, not needing to go anywhere or do anything, but simply being aware of what's unfolding. And the middle path there has to do with, if you will, greed and hatred, and not pushing anything that's happening away, and not reaching for other stuff, but to simply be there in the, if you will, in the middle of the path. Another way to think about the middle path, and Jiju is on my, might be might have to do with, as the Buddha described, the difference between really aesthetic practices and hedonism, and somehow being in the present moment, and again probably that greed and hatred thing, but not needing to go to those extremes. So there may be a couple different ways to think about it, but there probably are more. Bill, didn't see you there.
How about that middle path to be an effort to delusion? We were talking about effort earlier.
Yeah.
And really, I think the middle path is to recognize that effort is delusion, although at the same time, it's used to it.
Yeah.
Effort's still there. And yet, the way we look at effort is delusion.
I think it does. And it reminds me of I'm going to forget his name. I think it's Sen Yang, a contemporary teacher in New York, who sometimes describes, and this is the effort piece, let go of those thoughts, let go of those delusionary thoughts. And then when you recognize that you're kind of like on a path, and you're just going down that path of thinking, come back to the cushion. He said, now I know that's delusional, to think, come back to the cushion. But I don't know how to explain it. You know? But, and that's the effort. I mean, there has to be some effort. You know? A bit paradoxical. Anything else?
Just talking about being totally present, kind of the now. Can I do that and plan for the future at the same time?
If you, yeah.
Well, you definitely do that. There's no way you can be in the future. Just because you're thinking about the future
right.
Doesn't mean you're working in the future. Yeah.
You're planning.
Thinking about the future, I'm not here.
Yeah. There's really no place else to be other than here. You can't be in the future. But you can think about the future. And you know, we are human beings, and we have all of these, I mean, our brains secrete, and that's not a bad thing. And planning is not a bad thing. And being thoughtful is not a bad thing. And to be ethical, sometimes you have to be thoughtful. And so, yeah, you can. I think what you need, I mean, in the best of all possible worlds, as you're planning, you are not attaching to the outcomes of the plans, and you're aware that, you know, you're doing this in this moment, and you're kind of making up stories about, you know, how you want to go and where you want to be, but and be simply be aware of that. But you really can't be any place other than now, even though you plan, even though you project yourself and think of yourself someplace else, you are here. What? Yeah.
I was just that you're talking about the brain secreting what was it?
Thoughts. Secreting thoughts.
Wouldn't it be the mind? Is thoughts are arising in the mind.
I guess what I'm saying by that, and what I think Uchiyama meant, although I don't know, is that our physical brains, are organs, and they're set up to have chemical reactions, and those chemical reactions result in thoughts. Now, mind is not brain. So mind, your mind might be aware or contain or of the, might be aware of those.
But they happen at the same time, or when you say.
What happened? What?
Thought arises and the brain secretes. Both are they're inseparable. You know, the brain is the, my understanding, the brain is the vehicle that these mind and these thoughts are arising in. But to just say the brain secretes is too, I think, you know, reductionist, scientific reduction. You know, they're one.
Yeah, I'll grant you they're one. The question might be, if you accept that thoughts are nothing other than the results of chemical interactions in an organ. The question might be then, how does one have awareness of those? And usually we don't have awareness of our thoughts. I would say that probably in the best of all moments, we're aware of a minuscule number of the thoughts that are, and they're totally, we're totally unaware. And I think the process of the practice of Zazen is to bring awareness to those. Now, where that awareness comes from, and you might call it mind, you might call it, I don't have an answer for that. But I do experience it sometimes. One more, and then if there is one more, we'll do one more, and then we'll go have coffee and go. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was you or Tim that mentioned the multiplicity of cells. It's something I've been thinking about lately, and it kind of goes with what you just said. So there's kind of like the regular mat that runs rampant, and then sometimes there's a mat that says he doesn't know he's talking about. He's just, you know, talking and talking. Like, well, who's that? Who said that? You know, and then there's the nothing of just observing, you know, and not partaking at all. And it seems like that's another one that just lacks analytical or discriminative or logical. It's just not as, like, words are something that we abuse and run away with. And then this other one is just kind of, that is the middle path, to not attach or say, like, well, you know, to not struggle, or the one that just watches. Mm-hmm. But there can always be new selves that are like, oh, this is enlightenment, or, you know, get rid of that delusion and we'll be the enlightened Matt now, you know, like, which is impossible. It's certainly not going to happen that way.
Yeah. It was Tim who talked about multiplicity of selves. And I have no idea what he was talking about.